really, really, really do everything you can to make that head coach's job as easy as possible.
Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast, we get the great pleasure of speaking with one of the best coaches in the basketball business, Coach Brad Stevens. Coach Stevens has a short road of stops, but an incredible background nonetheless, as he grew from an assistant role at Butler to being the head coach and ultimately one of the best coaches Butler has seen for his six-year head coaching stint, including two Horizon Coach of the Year awards, two Final Four appearances, and seven regular and tournament Horizon League championships in total. Following Butler, Stevens stepped into a role with the Boston Celtics as a head coach for 8 years, and now, where he currently stands, as the president of basketball operations for the Boston Celtics. Please welcome Coach Brad Stevens. Video analysis is expensive and your budget probably isn't getting much bigger. Fulcrum Tech is here to help. Used by basketball teams at all levels from Division I all the way to high school, their Angles product is very similar to what you know and allows you to code, capture, and analyze with ease. All you have to do is import the raw video in Synergy with just the click of a mouse. Over the past 2 years, over 60% of Division I teams in conferences such as the SEC, Pac-12, American, NBC, and A-10, just to name a few, have made the postseason, all while using Fulcrum Tech and saving thousands and thousands of dollars compared to their old companies. Reach out to Fulcrum Tech on X at Fulcrum Tech or their sales@fulcrumtech.com. Just shoot them over an email and be sure to mention if you are a Rising Coaches member. Do more, spend less with Fulcrum Tech. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. You have Doug Caputo and Alan Major here. And today on the podcast, we get the pleasure of speaking with one of the legendary and former head coaches of Butler and the Boston Celtics, while currently the president of basketball operations for the Boston Celtics, Coach Brad Stevens. Coach Stevens, what's going on?
How are you guys? Legendary makes you feel old. And probably a little bit inaccurate, but whatever.
Well, yeah. I mean, hey, your status has spoke for itself. But as we mentioned, like the one thing, we'll just kind of dive right into it. Like your current position, the president of basketball operations with the Celtics. So obviously everybody hears about all the coaching side of things, you know, maybe not necessarily like the behind the scenes parts that you're kind of working with now. But if you could just tell us a little bit about like what that position entails and kind of some things maybe on a day-to-day life that you would course with.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's much different than coaching, but a lot of the things you learn in coaching are obviously applicable with 50 or 60 people in basketball operations, depending on the team and depending on, you know, what they're really prioritizing around the league. There's obviously a lot of responsibility that goes way beyond just the team, right? So you're really responsible for setting up the whole apparatus and making sure that, you know, we have the right people in the right spots to hopefully all add value to help our team, you know, win at the margins. Obviously in this role, the part that gets talked about is, you know, the putting the team together, but there are so many things that add to that, right? So you've got the team, the players, how they impact each other, you know, how they best accentuate each other. You have to have the coaches and the trainers and the sports science people and the chefs and everyone else all on the same page and on the same message. And then you've got a front office that has to be in the same, you know, in the same vein, focused on how we can continue to improve and also focused on how we stay on message. I probably can't emphasize that enough. That's probably my number one job is to make sure that, you know, we're all moving in one direction and, you know, we're not complicating things for the people that are in the arena when that ball is tipped. So that, you know, between putting a team together, trying to know how they will make each other better and how they'll fit, and then making sure we all stay on one message. I mean, that's not too dissimilar than what I was doing at Butler when I was coaching, but probably just at a bigger scale with the number of people we have.
Yeah, I heard this phrase once. Mike Brown was holding some Zooms during COVID, and I heard an assistant that used to be with the Bulls. He mentioned this phrase, and I loved it. And I'm sure you guys are already there as an organization, although no organization's perfect. but he used the phrase vertically aligned. Mm-hmm. And I loved it because, you know, the idea was, you know, upstairs, staff, players, you know, just that alignment of not just how we want to play and what are we trying to accomplish, but how do we want to live day to day with each other? And yeah. It sounds like you guys are there, but I know nobody's perfect, but would you say how big a deal would you say that is?
I don't know about the vertical part. I mean, unless we start with Kristaps, I guess we all go down from there height wise, but we just have to be aligned. We just have to be, it's so critical. It's so hard. And I think that the one thing that I would say, Alan, is no matter how good you are at it, you know, it's fragile and it can break easily today. You know, and I just think that's the world we live in. And, you know, when I was at Butler, I felt like we had great alignment. You know, the presidents that I worked for, both Bobby Fong and Jim Danko to Barry, who's been there now and retiring this year, to the assistants, to the players, to the support staff. We were all there to, you know, try to create an exceptional student athlete experience here. We're trying to create an exceptional work environment where we can put our strengths together and compete for championships. And you know, with that comes a lot of pressure. With that comes a lot of hard days. With that comes a lot of days that are really good, but they're all fragile. And so you have to constantly be working on that alignment.
And then one thing I want to talk about is just kind of completely going back in time a little bit. So this is one thing that always resonated with me. And I know there's going to be a bunch of people, especially with rising coaches, that'll be able to relate to this in a sense. So I know you probably talk about this well, as you know, a tremendous amount of times. But going back for you, you were working full-time for Eli Lilly, a pharmaceutical company. And then you end up taking a volunteer position with Butler. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but even picked up a position with Applebee's for a very brief time being. And I love to mention that part just because it says kind of where everything is transpired and how everything moved up. But you ultimately get offered a volunteer position with Thad Matta. But can you just talk about, like, especially for young coaches starting out, quitting that full-time job and just kind of going into the belly of the beast and ultimately getting to where you got now? I know it's a long road for a short story, but
I got offered a job my junior year in college and I took it like most juniors would. But my senior year, I started to realize like, I'm going to really miss this when I'm done playing. And so I had worked camps all the way through and knew Thad, gotten to know Thad working the Butler camp every summer. They employed a bunch of Division III players like me from all around the state that lived in Indianapolis to work the camps. And so when I was at Lilly and spent my first 9 months there, I just had decided, like, if I'm ever going to try this, now's the time. And I had a great connection in Thad that basically said, hey, I don't have a job for you, but you can come go to graduate school and work for free and, you know, sit in the back and do whatever we need you to do. And it was a great experience. And, you know, when an opportunity presented itself to move into a director of operations role. And then ultimately, before I was the head coach at Butler, I held every one of the roles that were there up to the head coach. So I had a good feel for like how that all worked. And I would say that the impetus for my move was I just wanted to be a part of a team again and have that scoreboard. I think there was a part of me and I think a lot of Division III kids would nod their heads at this. There was a part of me that always wanted to be in Division I to get a chance to maybe compete in that tournament someday and realize that coaching or being around the team was my best opportunity to do that. That probably played a bigger role now that I reflect back on it than I probably gave it credit for. And then I'll tell you, you know, frankly, that if anybody's considering doing that or anybody has the ability to do that, which I was really lucky because of who I knew, because of the networking of working camps, just wait for that first meeting you're in, because I'll never forget the first time I sat in a room with Todd Licklider and Mike Marshall, who had played at Butler, John Gross, who was an assistant, and Thad Matta. You know, it was like, wow, I don't know anything about coaching. You know, I grew up in the state of Indiana. I watched Coach Knight. I watched Coach Katie. You know, I watched the Pacer greats. I watched every Reggie Miller game. I knew every drill that I did. I knew how we played. We only ran motion, old school motion. And But when I got in that room and they started talking about the complexities of what they were thinking about on both ends of the court, talking about recruiting and piecing a team together and the value added and the value take away if you don't put the right people together, I walked out of there. You know, you talk about like imposter syndrome. You're like, I should be a volunteer. You know, I don't know what I don't know. Like, and so I had a great, healthy respect for how hard that job was going to be right out of the gate.
Yeah. And to tap a little bit more on that, you know, obviously going from college to the pros, like how did you, let me rephrase that. What did you keep that you just said, hey, okay, I feel pretty good that this will translate. And then what did you add? And what was the immediate thing? Like, hey, I gotta really lean into this here because this is different. This is a different league. Obviously the talent, that is what it is, but just going from that college to pro situation.
Well, it's such a different game with the 24-second shot clock, with the 48 minutes. You know, I learned that first year, that extra 8 minutes is eight more minutes for the studs on the other team to be on the court. That's hard, you know, and I think that that's a real thing, you know, in a 40-minute NCAA game or FIBA game or, you know, 32-minute high school game, you know, a flurry of shot making may determine the game and you may not be able to catch up even if you are the more talented group. Oftentimes that doesn't happen quite as much, especially over the course of a season and a 7-game series at this level, but certainly shows itself some. The difference in the game, the travel schedule, and the lack of practice time, I all say were really things that jumped out. You know, if I ever got a chance to, you know, be in the room with the people that are making the rules in college basketball, I would push heavy and hard for 4 quarters, advance the ball, FIBA rules. Like, it's so different than any other game that's played, the college game. And I just think it would prepare coaches better for making the transition to the NBA. And it would be, I think, good for the game just because, you know, I think that the 20 minutes, the 7 fouls, there's so many things that we could tweak to make it more like the rest of the world. And hey, we've got our issues too, right? We play 48 minutes instead of 40, but ultimately I do think that would be one thing that I would say. The difference in all of that, I would say that the biggest difference, Alan, is the travel and the practice. You don't get a chance to practice. The travel is insane. And it's way better than it used to be because we travel charter, but the way your body feels as a coach at the end of the year, I don't miss that. I have a 12-month cadence right now, and I join the team when I need to join the team. I also fly commercial in the middle of the day some. You know, it's hard to get in at 3 a.m. several times a week, and that's a real thing, and that's why I – you know, sometimes when I see scores at night or whatever the case may be, I have to take into account everything. These guys are otherworldly in so many other ways, but they're also human.
Yeah. No, I love that. I wish I was with you or am with you on the fact of the, you know, with the 4-quarter thing, that the game would just flow so much easier.
Well, resetting the fouls is a big deal.
Absolutely.
You know, like resetting the 5 so you don't – how many college games yet where it's 7 fouls with 11 minutes to go? And, you know, I just think there's ways that would make it more consistent. But that said, I love going to college games. So I don't want to get on a soapbox here. I'm never going to be invited to that room anyway. So it doesn't matter.
Well, the toughest thing is TV would go nuts, right? Like the TV people would lose their minds with faster games because that's fewer commercials. You know, and that's such a big deal now with TV rights and the money and all that. So, you know, a faster game, they'd be like, you know, this is ridiculous. The game's over in 1 hour and 50 minutes. What's going on? You know,
I don't know how the TV aspect was affected. But when I first got here, we had 3 mandatory timeouts in the second and fourth quarter. And we took one away, NBA, and it really improved the flow of the game, you know. We had 7-3 in the first quarter. We had, I think, 9-6-3 in the second, and they just went 7-3, 7-3. And I just think that anything that we can do in a in a world that's more focused on small windows has been a positive. But it's, I totally understand and don't know all of the economic ramifications of it.
I mean, they've even implemented for, I'm currently, you were mentioned on D3, I'm currently at a D3 coach and was a former D3 player, and they implemented media timeouts for us right now. And it's like, we don't even have a media, but they put them in
because 16, 12, 8, and 4.
16, 12, 8, 4. Yep. The only reason they did it, they're prepping us for, the tournament. The championship, tournament championship, and then the NCAAs from all there. So
I always thought when I was coaching at Butler, I was like, our guys don't need to be in shape like we did playing Division III because we could play 20 straight minutes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We didn't have that.
No doubt.
Yep.
But the 4-minute increments makes it a little bit different.
So one thing though, we'll kind of like flip a little bit here and go over and talk about just as a head coach. So as you know, Rising Coaches is a platform. I know I kind of mentioned it, but a platform to be able to help coaches rise up in the industry, but also just learn and develop their skills. So talk about your head coaching philosophy on a year-to-year basis. So of course, we'll start with Butler, and then if you want to talk about Boston as well, but I feel like with college, it would resonate more with people. How would you encourage basically young coaches to just kind of grow their own philosophies?
Yeah, well, first of all, if I'm a young coach and I'm trying to get in and I'm trying to latch on, you know, you could bring a huge binder of your philosophy. Your philosophy is what, for me, what Thad Matta's philosophy was. And then what Todd Licklider's philosophy is, and you got to embrace it and you got to sell it and you got to be on their message. You may have things as a young assistant that you think you would do differently, or maybe you're taking mental notes or writing a journal about how you would coach the team when you ever get a chance. But I think the one thing that I would say about having a philosophy is build that over time in at night or on the bus or on the plane, but in the weeds of the work, like really, really, really do everything you can to make that head coach's job as easy as possible. And, you know, when I got hired by Thad on a full-time basis, you know, he told me, and I never started at Applebee's, by the way, but he told me you can ditch the Applebee's idea and you can, your job is to make my life easier. You know, I was a director of ops. And at that time, I was probably the most, you know, the person who knew the computer the best, right? Because we were still VHS to VHS with the...
Yeah, right. Editing, right.
So my technology plus, I guess, which really, you know, I wasn't that good at it. But my ability to use a computer and be helpful in that way and to be as organized as possible, hopefully helped in that small way. Once you build a philosophy, I think, and then you get your opportunity, it is number one about getting the right people in the room. And it is absolutely, you know, every person you bring into your room, coaches, ops, anyone in a support staff role, trainers and players, they're all going to impact each other every single day. And so no matter how much talent you bring in, no matter how many guys are studs, if you don't have a functional, aligned, you know, one direction, then it's going to bite you. And so from a coaching philosophy standpoint, that's my number one. And then my number two is once you figure out the strengths of your team, build a system around that, you know, and if you're lucky enough to get, you know, to the place where, you know, the Bill Selfs of the world or Izzo or Painter, you know, those guys that have been there in one spot forever, recruit to who you want to be. Right. But not everybody can start that way. And I think that ultimately, you know, especially if you're at a mid-major, which we were most of my time there, as far as mid-major conference, we weren't a mid-major team. You know, we had to recruit, you know, guys that would be the best they could be. And sometimes we had to morph to their strengths.
And Butler always had a DNA, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Just coaching against you guys.
And they do this year.
Yeah, for sure.
That DNA they have this year is a lot like the DNAs of the really good teams we've had.
No doubt. No doubt about it. What about just from an offensive defensive standpoint, what were some of your kind of cornerstones? Because I think that's another thing is people tap into what we're doing is, you know, everybody's kind of creating their own bowl of chili when they're trying to figure out their philosophies. Yeah. And, you know, chili tastes good in a lot of different ways. But, you know, what was that for you? Did anything change from Butler to Boston philosophy-wise? I know some things may have tweaked or sure, but tap into that on both sides of the ball a little bit.
Yeah, I'd say that the move to the NBA made me a way better offensive coach. And I think that because you have to be quick, you have to be decisive. We ran, you know, several different things over my 8 years here that kind of fit the team. You know, the stuff we were running when Isaiah Thomas was here was much different than the stuff, you know, 4 years later that we were running when Kimball Walker showed up. So I just think like that was fun because you're always thinking about it and you're always putting it down. I'd say offensively, you know, everything to me starts with skill, you know, spacing and pace being defined as up the court or in the action. You know, any stagnation's a bad deal. You know, I think that's our biggest challenge is to stay away from that with the Celtics. And I think that a lot of teams in the NBA get like that over the course of a long game. But, you know, stagnation's not what we need. You know, we need to make sure that we are spaced reading and making quick, sound basketball decisions. On the other end of the court, I think it's all about how you decide to play. I mean, the game starts with pick and roll coverages because so many teams are running pick and rolls. I mentioned in the 90s that was blasphemous in the state of Indiana. You weren't allowed to run a pick. If you ran to the ball, you were out.
Yeah, no doubt.
That's changed a lot.
Yeah.
So I think once you get back and set your defense, to me, it's about how do you impact the ball? How do you impact you know, their ability to get the shots they want? And you come up with a game plan and a system to try to do that. I think the thing that I've seen over the course of time in the NBA specifically, it's probably become a little less system-based and a lot more reads-based. But at the end of the day, you better be something. And you better have an ability to impact people physically and be into the ball and keep the ball in front of you and make it as tough as possible and rebound the ball to have a chance to win.
I think I'm more amazed in the past, I don't know, and I don't know if the Warriors kind of kickstarted this, but just in the past 8 to 10 years, the level of cutting that's now grown into the NBA, like the guy's ability to play off the ball now is so much better than maybe Joe Fan gives him credit for, right? Because they just say, it's an ISO league. And yeah, there's a heavy amount of isolation that goes on and matchup and who we're going to pick on, things like that. But the ability for guys to now cut and play off drives or cut and play off post feeds, whether it's, you know, split action, you know, all these things, I've been really impressed by that. I think guys don't get enough credit in the NBA for being able to play off the ball.
Golden State's the standard bearer of that. There's no question they're the best cutting team in the league. I think if you get into the playoffs, deep into the playoffs, you better be able to score three ways. You better be able to score when you have a matchup advantage. You better be able to score in different pick and rolls, no matter who sets them. You know, we'll, in most games, we'll roll everybody. You know, we'll be rolling Peyton Pritchard. You know, we'll be rolling Kristaps Porzingis. We'll be rolling Derek White. You know, I think you got to be able to play against the switch and pick and roll. And then the third one is then you've got to be able to play with cutting. You have to be able to move. You have to have a motion, you know, go to, if you will. And the Warriors do the best job of making that randomized. And, you know, I think Steve's done an amazing job with that. I think that Steph and Clay, you know, and Draymond to an extent, because Draymond's kind of the hub of it for all those years. But Steph and Clay, you know, they played in motion systems in college, which are pretty unique when you really think about it. Like McKillop was cutting. McKillop was doing all that stuff at Davidson, you know, or Clay played for Tony.
Yeah, mover blocker. Yeah.
Washington State, a lot of, you know, the blocker mover and the baseline cuts. So that was in their wheelhouse. That was in their strengths. And, you know, Steve has done a great job of building that out. Those are hard teams to play against. And, you know, I think that that's why you have to, the best teams in our league can score it a bunch of different ways. And I think if you start relying on specifically the isolation, it can become a problem.
And then I wanted to ask one final question before we cut to the final segment for us. But so one thing about your coaching style, and I'll just say, like, I've always found it unique, especially growing up, because you always see all these other coaches getting intense, you know, the Bobby Knights and all those guys, like very intense coaches, right, up in people's faces screaming. But you were obviously the exact opposite side of the spectrum. And there's a quote from you that I saw. I said, a calm coach means a team that will remain poised in difficult game situations, while a nervous coach means a team that plays on edge. I don't want to lose a game because of my approach. So can you just talk about, like, kind of your mindset? Because I even saw it said something about you were like, even though on the outside I look poised, on the inside I maybe wasn't so poised, maybe a little more frantic on the on the inside. But can you talk about your mindset here and kind of like what all the more calm coaching side of things kind of meant?
Well, I'd say number one is the more prepared I felt, the more, you know, I could just stay in the moment and not get emotional. If I wasn't as prepared as I should have been, that's when I was probably on edge. So that just tells you a little bit about why you're on edge, right? You're on edge because somebody else is dictating the game to you in a lot of ways. And you just need to avoid that, you know, with your preparation long before that. I would say that I don't remember saying that quote, but I remember the game that would have inspired something to that ilk. And that was, you know, I think we were 7 or 8-0 when I was in my first year at Butler. We had won the Great Alaska Shootout. We had just beaten Ohio State on our home floor. And then we went on to start conference play in early December. And we squeaked one out at Detroit. And then we went to Wright State, who had beat us the year before in the conference tournament. And, you know, I was 8 games into my head coaching career. I was on edge. We put up 41 and we were terrible. And our players played on edge. Our players played tight. And it really hit me when I was watching the film, like, no wonder they played tight. You know, that game was on me, right? So, like, I learned from that point on that I can't be that. And so, you know, I would say, Doug, it was as much of a conscious decision. It was probably more of a conscious decision to be that way than actually who I am, because I didn't want to cost us the opportunity to play free and to play without fear and to play on edge. I just no way to play. And I felt like I cost our team that game. And, you know, I told myself I'd never do that again. It didn't stop me from getting a few texts, getting ejected once.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes you do get on edge when you're down about 30.
Yeah. Right. Right.
I think that's okay.
Right. Yeah. No, that's I'm glad you said that, because again, this platform is so much about helping guys grow, and everybody's got to be who they are. But
yeah,
so much of what happens. I remember being at Charlotte. I used to get emails from fans because I didn't get heated enough. Like, they wanted me going after refs and grabbing guys by the neck. And
try coaching in Boston.
Yeah, I could imagine.
That's fair.
Right. If I could imagine.
They're like, this guy.
Yeah. So they, you know, but they just, people just don't understand. You know, you're literally enabling your guys to fly off the handle. You know, I mean, they're going to embody what they see. So just trying to stay in the moment and stay calm, because there's enough stress in the game, and there's enough stress going on that if you get tied to every little thing like that, I mean, it's just, that's a bad formula. So
we and you and I both grew up in Central Indiana, as Doug mentioned, with Coach Knight and Coach Katie. I mean, you had
slightly emotional dudes. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't know how you felt, but those were my basketball, like,
100%
coaching icons.
No doubt.
Yeah. It took me to get to Butler to watch Thad, and specifically Todd, who looked at the game so uniquely and very rarely raised his voice and completely trusted the players. To really look at, coaching can be different. It can be to your personality, whatever that personality may be. And it doesn't have to be one way. You know, all of us that grew up playing in Central Indiana, also probably played for high school coaches and AAU coaches that were like indie.
No doubt. Yo, like for sure.
And, yeah, no question. So that was a great experience for me to learn that. And, you know, I probably would have lasted, I only lasted till I was 44 anyways in coaching, but I probably would have lasted a lot shorter amount of time if I would have been like that.
So what we'll do is we'll cut to our final segment too, which is three quick hitters. So ultimately it's just three quick questions. Yep. And then we'll round it out with our final question at the end and we'll be all set from there. So the first quick hitter would be, for you, you were known for your expert abilities of breaking down film. So when you watch film, if you had to pick one thing for when you're watching your own team, what is that one thing that really stands out to you when watching film?
Body language and pace. The pace of play is not just running up and down the court. It's how you cut. It's how timely you are to get to where you need to go. On defense, it's your energy level into the ball, your activity level, doing what you're supposed to do, but also doing it with great, you know, great substance. You know, bad body language gets you beat. End of story. It just has a corrosive effect. And so, you know, that'd probably be the two things that I would look for right away.
No, I love that. And then when you need, especially for you, I mean, you're at the, you know, college and you go to the NBA, you're at the top of the top. So like when you need more fresh information on a tactic or tendency, where do you typically turn for like more fresh information? Is there anywhere?
When I was coaching, I would say, first of all, when you're watching film of all these NBA teams and you're getting ready to play, you're stealing a lot. Amazing coaches in college that I coached against, amazing coaches in the NBA. And as you're going through a season, you're generating ideas from watching your opponents all the time. I would say in addition to that, you know, I probably spent a lot of time watching FIBA and watching the international play to, you know, draw new things or add new things to what we were doing. And I do think coming to the NBA, one of my advantages was that I was at a mid-major. And the reason I say that is because we couldn't get the elite big guy, at least by the rankings. We avoided recruiting the slow big guy. And we just decided we're going to be small, fast, and skilled. And I think that, you know, entering the NBA in 2013 with that background, you know, as the game has kind of shifted, probably helped.
And then the final quick hitter is when you're hiring a coach throughout a process or whatever it may be for any position, what is like the number one skill that you look for in somebody?
Yeah, the smart, humble, and hardworking. That's it. You know, I think that obviously we want to have creative, good ideas, smart people. We need people that are willing to put in the time because, you know, players know if you're not putting in the time and players really appreciate it for those that really invest the time. But it all goes to nothing if it's all about your own ambition and it's all about you, you know, and I think that the humble part is pretty darn critical. We've had great, I had amazing staffs at Butler. I've had amazing staffs here. I've got head coaches now all over the country that I got a chance to work with, you know, in the last 14 years. And it's been really fun to see them do great. That's probably the most like, most enjoyable part for me, watching the people that you used to coach with, coach somewhere else and kind of take off. But those are the things that were most important to me.
And then the final question to wrap it all up is if you had to pick and narrow down, you kind of touched on it earlier, but one piece of advice for young rising coaches who are trying to get their foot in the door, and then how can they accomplish this piece of advice?
Well, I think number one is if you're going to try to get your foot in the door, it's obviously networking, working camps is the way that I did it, but being able to go places where you have a chance to meet people. But then you got to be able to show like, in those moments, what you can do, right? So camps is a good thing, good place to start. I don't know how much of that there is anymore, but that's how I got my start. But once you're in the door, I think you can't get it twisted, can't get lost. It's about the job you do. You know, it's about you know, the signature that you put on your work every single day to help the team become the best that they can be. You know, once you're in that door, it's not as much about networking. It's about, you know, are you really putting it, are you really giving everything you have for the good of the group. And those were early on, Alan would second this, early, and Doug, you would too, early on, those are long hours without much that are pretty thankless. Probably the most enjoyable time of my coaching career because I didn't have any responsibility. I was just trying to help us win by the margins and make sure the pizza got on the bus. Like I didn't, and so like end of the day, you know, enjoy that part of it and learn and take notes. But man, it's about the job you do at every step along the way.
That wraps it up. I mean, does anybody have any final comments before we get to the closing remarks?
No. Hey, Brett, I just want to say thanks again for doing this, man. I appreciate it. It was great to see you when you were here in town. And I've always appreciated your friendship, both as a competitors briefly for a little stretch. But
Alan beat us at Hinkle, Doug.
Oh, yeah.
Alan brought Charlotte up to Hinkle and beat us, and we were really good. Both teams were good. We were like, I think we were top 15 in the country or somewhere around.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. No, I mean.
I think so. He says it all.
Humbly. No, they had a guy go off. We had a lead and they had a guy just go on like NBA Jams mode. I'm dating myself with the video game, but like
it was funny. You talk about like styles of play and, you know, when Gordon and Shelvin and Ron and all those guys, Matt Howard were all there. We were probably more sets and we would give those guys the ball more and let them be them and play off more pick and roll and those type of things. But once those guys all left, we had Clark and Dunham and that was that team and Rodney Clark. And we ran way more motion. We ran way more cutting. It was completely different than 4 years before. And it was as much fun as I've ever had coaching. We weren't probably as good as our record. So teams like Charlotte come in and bullied us a little bit. And knew they could bully us coming into it. It's not a great feeling.
Well, our team shot 29% that season. So our whole thing was just get closer.
Like go get the ball.
Yeah, we just ball.
Lots of opportunities for rebounds.
Try to go get it back and try to get it back again after that. But
yeah.
But no, just again, I've always appreciated your friendship, man. And hopefully, I can get out there to Boston and hang out at some point.
That'd be great. Go Dogs. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. And that does it for another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. Again, you got Brad Stevens. Thank you again for joining us, Doug Caputo and Alan Major. Keep working. Keep rising, coaches. Take care. Prepare your team for success this season with our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball, the official number one selling shooting machine in basketball. If you're looking to transform and focus your team's training efforts, all you have to do is mention Rising Coaches or tell them we sent you with the Rising Coaches podcast. For an additional $300 off, select Dr. Dish shooting machines. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together.